Radio.
Guinness God presents Sam Clear, speaking on the topic, Pumas, Prayers and Pistols, the fight for Christian unity. Guinness and God is brought to you by the Catholic Life Archdiocesan team of the Archdiocese of Canberra and Goulburn.
Thank you. Good evening. How are you doing? A bit funny actually hearing that I played AFL for two games and then decided God was calling me to other things. The real thing that happened was that I had my 14th broken bone and decided it was time to stop playing football. And it was a few years later that I felt that call. It didn't actually happen and I left footy. So what I'm going to, as you've obviously heard, I am Sam from Tassie. And this, what I'm going to talk about this evening has its foundations at university. So I studied mechanical engineering at the University of Tasmania in Hobart. And our faculty happened to be one of the most male-dominated to ever pass through the university. Out of 200 students, there were only four women. And it was every ist you can think of. It was racist, sexist, chauvinist. In one afternoon, the engineering faculty consumed 32 barrels of beer. And the lifestyle that went with it was horrendous. And a lot of those guys still haven't been able to stop getting themselves into trouble, 10 years down the track after graduation. But it was also a time when I was confronted by, the disunity of the church. What was happening was there was a guy in my engineering class who found out that I went to church on Sundays. And he went to a non-denominational kind of Pentecostal church. And he basically confronted me one day and said, "Sam, do you actually believe in Jesus?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, why don't you become a Christian?" I said, "Well, I am." He said, "No, you're a Catholic. That's not Christian." Anyway, so he set about over the next year, every now and then, coming to me with more and more material, trying to evangelise me so I'd become a Christian. And then, to be honest, it was almost like I had a mini Bible study. It was just in the form of argument, but it was actually good for me to a point. But then one day he sent me an email, and I opened it up, and it was pornography. And I shut it down, but I had the Bronx cheer from the guy sitting behind me who wanted me to send it on to them. And then I went and found this guy, and I said, "Why did you just send me that?" He said, "What? What's the issue?" He said, "It's human body. It's beautiful." I said, "Hang on." I said, "You just sent me porn." I said, "Don't you have any concept of sin?" And he said, "That's where you Catholics are wrong. If you'd ever read your Bible, you'd read that once you accept Jesus into your life, you're dead to sin. You can't sin again." And kind of alarm bells are going off, and I went and chatted with my parish priest, and thankfully he led me to the piece in Paul, one of Paul's letters that he was referring to, and put it into context. But that set off in me this desire to find out what other churches actually taught. And I, at the end of my degree, was feeling very challenged that, yes, I was going to church on Sundays with one of the other guys in my engineering faculty, and for that we were known as the God Boys, but I wasn't really putting it into action in any way. So I was in love with the idea of going away and being a missionary just for 1 year. I wanted to go to Africa. I ended up moving to Sydney. And I joined Youth Mission Team Australia. I don't know if this makes sense or not, but it was the one thing I didn't want to do. And so that's why I did it. I didn't want anything to do with teenagers. I did mechanical engineering for a reason. There's no people involved. And so I went off and did youth ministry for a year and loved it. And I stayed on. But I think I had a very... that experience was very much a deepening of faith as well, and being introduced to a daily prayer life and going to daily mass. And so I wanted to stay on and ended up doing 5 years. So I did one as a volunteer and then four as a manager. One in Sydney, two in Adelaide and two in Melbourne. During that time, the disunity of the church just seemed to grow around me. The more that I was becoming more and more aware of it. And I was seeing all these different denominations coming together for missionary projects, but then watching it descend into like a playground fight when they found out what church the other people were from. And until it'd be name calling, literally, until someone stormed out and the actual project they came together for was lost. The moment that kind of tipped me though was, I was living in Melbourne, going to St. Benedict's Parish down in Burwood, and the priest had been continually telling us to prepare for Mass by doing an hour's reading before coming, or an hour's prayer. I never did it, but on this particular day did. And the story that I happened to pull out of the book I pulled out of the bookcase was a story of men and women who had come to faith. It was just their testimonies, and one of them was a Baptist evangelical who had become a Catholic. So it detailed his story to becoming a Baptist evangelical, and then his story to becoming a Catholic. And I used to cop a fair bit from my non-Catholic Christian friends for not being Christian. So I wanted to know why this guy ended up becoming Catholic. The story was interesting, but at the end of his story, what jumped out at me was that he lost his friends and family. His mum and dad disowned him. They felt he had disowned Christ by becoming Catholic, so they never spoke to him again. They've never met their grandchildren. His best man never spoke to him again. His wife wanted a divorce because he was becoming Catholic. For me, reading that was like standing at a car crash and not knowing first aid. Just seeing something horrific in front of me. We often talk about the church being the body of Christ, and it was like seeing Christ crucified again. That through disunity, we crucified him again. And whether it was the engineering brain or the male brain kicking in, I wanted to fix it, and I couldn't. I'd studied mechanical engineering. I hadn't studied theology or philosophy. I had no idea what I could possibly do to help it, but I wanted to fix it. I couldn't. And I ended up a few days later kneeling down before Mass and praying a very simple prayer, which was, "Dear God, I would love to help you, but sorry, mate, you're on your own. I'm out. The problem's too big. There's too much history. There's too much bitterness. There's too much apathy in some areas. I can't help." In the silence that followed, just in my guts, it felt like God said, "Sam, you're right. You can't fix it. But I can. I need you to pray for unity." It became the one little thing that I could do on the side, was pray for unity. And I began to invite a lot of my friends to pray for unity. But a lot of them actually rejected that and said, "No, we're not going to pray for unity. Like, unity already exists. It's just that all these other churches aren't a part of it. They're not proper Christians." And they wouldn't even pray for it. And I was really frustrated with it. And seeing, because I was now kind of captivated by it, I was seeing it everywhere and seeing examples of it everywhere. And then one day I was looking at a world map, very innocently, but thinking about the disunity of the church, and thought, how awesome would it be to do what my faith hero in life is, St. Francis of Assisi. I thought, how awesome would it be to do what St. Francis did? Just sell up and walk. And I thought, I was tracing a route out across the map. I was thinking, just walk around the world on foot as a protest walk, similar to what Mahatma Gandhi did across India, but walking and praying for unity. And stop in every church that I pass, whether it's Catholic, Orthodox, Pentecostal, Evangelical, non-denominational, interdenominational, Protestant, and invite them to at least set a foundation in praying for each other. And as simple as that thought was, it never left. It just kind of grew over time. It kind of solidified. And I set out 5 people further down their faith walk than myself and made a deal with God that if all 5 said yes to this missionary idea, I'd do it. All 5 said yes. I wanted that to happen, but I wasn't sure if it was just my own doing, wanting to go on this walk. So ended up selling up, spent a year planning, selling up, and started in João Pessoa, the easternmost point of Brazil, and headed up across South, Central, and North America to Edmonton in Canada. It took 1 year to walk that far. I then flew across the Bering Strait and took the train through Siberia. It was minus 40 degrees Celsius on average in the daytime. I was there in the middle of winter. So we had decided before I left Australia that I wouldn't walk that section. The mission was about prayer and inviting people to pray for unity. I just happened to take it out on foot. I didn't walk the entire way around the world. I walked 15,500 kilometres. You can walk a lot further if you want. I got off the train in Moscow. It was still the middle of winter, so it was still decently cold. And from St. Basil's Cathedral in the Red Square, walked on across Russia, and then down through Europe, down to Rome, around the Mediterranean, over the Pyrenees Mountains, and on to Cape Finisterre, the westernmost point of mainland Europe. So it was a year and a half of walking. It was a very simple mission. Walk, pray, and invite people to pray for unity. But the execution of that mission was exceedingly difficult. Had to learn 9 languages while I was walking. I was a jock at school. I didn't learn languages. English was hard enough. And so had to learn 9 languages as I went. I was held up at gunpoint twice. I was robbed at knife point by 4 men. I was beaten up on the side of the road a number of times. I twice woke up in the middle of the night with a man having broken into my room, not to rob me, but to get into bed with me in 2 different countries. Apparently, I'm attractive. It was a very scary thing to wake up to with their hand already on me in a pitch black room and have to fight them off and to do it twice. I came face to face with dangerous animals on the side of the road a few times, nearly lost my life. I was arrested on 3 occasions, once in Belarus, the last remaining dictatorship of Europe, by the KGB, who still exists there, the secret police. I don't normally say this. The reason I got arrested, I walked across Belarus, a dictatorship, wearing a red and white striped t-shirt. Who here knows that the colours of revolution against the dictatorship are red and white stripes? Information that would have been handy before I crossed the border. And then once they arrested me, found out my visa was invalid, so that didn't help my cause. I was also twice arrested in the United States of America because they couldn't figure out if I was a missionary or a terrorist. And Homeland Security, under armed guard, took me into the interrogation room the first time for 30 minutes, the second time for 4.5 hours. They eventually let me go, and they assured me they'd be praying for unity as well. So it was kind of worthwhile. I was hospitalised quite a few times. I had salmonella poisoning, typhoid fever, food poisoning 4 times. I dislodged my hip at one stage walking down the road in Mexico, gawking at a big mountain, thinking that's so cool, and I trod in a hole and dislodged my hip. I also had a bad laceration on my left big toe, a big cut. And I was walking about 40 kilometres a day on average, and through the tropics with the heat and the humidity, it was just getting worse and worse. It wasn't healing. And it was getting to the point where the flesh underneath my toe was actually halfway out across the nail. And so it was operated once in Panama, in Central America. That operation was good. It healed up fine. I walked on. And then it blew out again in the United States. So it was operated on a second time in Billings, Montana. And Billings, Montana, like this is like going to the hospital down the road here. It's not third world medicine. I presume the hospital down the road's good. Yep. And the doctors had a meeting at the end of my bed and turned to me and said, "Sam, what's your pain threshold like?" I said, "Average." I said, "Well, we're really sorry, but you've got a really bad staph infection in this. There's no blood circulation. It's pointless to use anaesthetic, so we're not. But we're going to operate on it. We need you to grit your teeth and don't flinch. We'll be as fast as we can." My younger brother Chris was with me. Chris works at the Launceston General Hospital in Launceston. Obviously the Launceston General Hospital, the LGH. And he wasn't interested in the pain his big brother was about to go through. He wanted to see what happens when they operate without anaesthetic. So he grabbed a video camera and filmed while they cut the big toenail in half with pliers, ripped half the nail out. It snapped on the way out, so they had to go back and get the bits that were still embedded, then cut the flesh away, patched it all up. All while Chris is filming and going, "Suck it in, you big sook," and continuing to film. It was a very simple mission, but a very difficult journey to execute. It's also difficult to put into perspective what it's like walking that far. I lost 14 kilograms over the course of the journey. I've put most of that back on. So I'm already a beanpole. I looked like a marathon runner by the end of it, and I had a trimmed beard at the end and was looking like a cross between Forrest Gump and Jesus, and was looking forward to heading back home. When I was down in South America, when I'd started down there, going across Brazil, the hottest day that I had while walking was in my first week, and it was 47 degrees Celsius for a 42 kilometre day. At 6 a.m. it was 31 degrees Celsius, and it just got hotter as the sun rose. At that temperature, The road surface, the asphalt, was over 100 degrees Celsius. If you ever watch the Australian Open, they give the air temperature and the court temperature. They're quite different. So the air temperature is 47, road surface is over 100, and that meant that the soles of my boots, the rubber soles, are actually becoming tacky underneath. They're kind of sticking to the bitumen. And I had what they call a camelback water system, so water bladder with a tube. Ended up with two after a while, just out of necessity, and a drop of water fell out onto the bitumen. And when it hit it, it just went and evaporated and was gone. So very hot. I drank 14 litres of water that day and finished severely dehydrated and couldn't move the next day. So very difficult getting through that part of the world. Had a few active volcanoes to walk around in Central America and a big earthquake of 6.2, which is the only earthquake I've ever been in, so it probably felt bigger than it actually was. And eventually, though, made it up out of the tropics. It took about 8 months to walk out of the tropics, up into Mexico and then into the United States. Winter hit very hard when I was in Denver, Colorado. It started to snow and it just got colder and colder the further north I headed, and I was heading north into a winter. All the geese were flying south and I'm the one solitary figure stupidly heading north. And when I was crossing the USA-Canada border, a low pressure system and a cold front swept in, and at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the temperature bottomed out at minus 33 degrees Celsius. Now, at minus 33, if you haven't been in those temperatures, if you go outside as you're dressed right now, any skin that you have exposed anywhere will blister like a third degree burn within about 10 minutes. But that doesn't matter, because within 30 seconds, your lungs will begin to freeze. And after about 5 to 10 minutes, you'll feel, oh, it actually hurts. You take one breath in and it just generally hurts. But after, if you keep breathing, after 5 or 10 minutes, you just pass out through lack of oxygen because your lungs are frozen, and then you end up dying. So everything had to be, that actually wasn't a joke. Everything has to be covered up completely. I actually need a volunteer for a second, please, to help me out. Anyone? Can we come forward? So what's your name?
Peter,
nice to meet you. I'm Sam. Peter, I'm going to get you to throw this on. This is my balaclava that I wore while walking. It has been washed, apart from a Carmelite monk wearing it last night. He was fine. Okay, so this is my balaclava. I wasn't wearing it when I got arrested. Can you throw that on as well? Keep that nose piece over your nose. Okay. So, this is what I was wearing while I was walking, and if you could walk around so people can actually see what you've got on there. Now, if you look in front of Peter's mouth, there's a layering system of material. And, thanks, Peter. And what's happening is it's acting like a heating filter. So as Peter breathes out, the warmth and moisture of his breath sticks to that material, it warms it up, and as he breathes back in, it warms the air up, and so instead of breathing in at minus 33, it enters his lungs at around about minus 10. So it's still really cold, but it won't kill him. He can continue walking down the road. And I'd have other gear on. I had a beanie on and obviously all the jackets, etc. Now, one of the big problems is the gloves. So I can just get you to throw this on. It's just a body armor glove, and it's good to around about 0 degrees Celsius. It's a tight-fitting insulated glove. As it drops below zero, you've got to upgrade and put this over the top. It's a synthetic leather insulated glove, so composite glove, just throw that on too. And when you combine the two of them, you can get down to around about minus 10, maybe minus 15 at a stretch. I'll get you to throw that one on too. I've lost the other little small one. I lost it in Russia. It's on the side of the road somewhere. So when you've got the two combined, down to about minus 10 to minus 15. As it gets colder, again, you've got to upgrade once more, and you've got to throw this over the top of them. It's a composite leather synthetic, this time ski knit. It's filled with goose down, and it's good to around about minus 20 to minus 25 degrees Celsius. So, as it gets colder again, and you start to get down, I've just realised that I didn't put one of my props up here. As it gets colder again, and I've got no idea where I stuck it. Nick? Can I have your help for 1 second, please? Can you go through that, look in the top pocket? Find
the muesli bar.
Now, with all this gear on, down to minus 20 to minus 25. As it gets colder, again, you have to put into the palm of your hands and into your boots chemical reaction pads.
Thanks, Nick.
And you, I don't know if you can buy them here in Canberra. If you go to the snow, you probably would have seen them. You just buy them at service stations in the USA or Canada. You crack them open, they heat up to 50 degrees Celsius when they react to the air, and they'll stay like that for about 7 hours. And you can walk on. The day that it got to minus 33, the one in my left hand stopped working after 30 minutes and I didn't have a backup. And so by the end of the day, I'd lost all sensation in my fingertips and couldn't grip anything, couldn't actually feel anything at all. So I was very lucky to get through the day without losing sensation, without permanent frostbite. Now, the big issue, walking across Canada, on average, it was 50 kilometres between the towns. So that's how far I walked each day was dictated by how far it was to the next town. At those temperatures, I couldn't take any of that gear off at any stage. So you've got that on for 10 to 12 hours while walking, and my metabolism was racing, both due to the distances I was walking and the cold, just trying to keep warm. And so I was eating four meals a day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and another meal at 3 a.m. in the morning. So I'd have two sleeps, a sleep, a meal, and another sleep, and then get up and keep walking. And between meals, I'd eat around about 20 muesli bars every day. Peter, can you please open the muesli bar? And I'm having a drink.
Yeah!
You've got half of this about. Well done. So the next problem, and it did take a while, and sometimes but there are still some muesli bars sitting on the side of the road in Canada that I just kicked off the road and went for another one. The next problem is eating it. And there's no hole here. Hang on, get your hands out of the way. There's no hole here to poke the muesli bar up into, so you've got to pull that mouthpiece down. Now, have you all seen the movie Dumb and Dumber? There's a scene in Dumb and Dumber where he's sitting on a chairlift and he goes, "Ooh, frost!" and puts his tongue onto the frost and he's stuck. His tongue sticks to it and he can't get off. Same principle applies. Because Peter's been breathing through this, there's moisture on it, and as soon as he pulls it down and stops breathing through it, it begins to stick to itself. And it just gets tighter and tighter the longer you leave it. By longer, I mean a minute, until it becomes a solid ice block, at which point, when you go to lift it back up again, you expose your neck and your chin to the elements. And you can't just pull it apart. It'll snap. My brother and I did an experiment. We ducked our hair in water, ran outside, then ran back inside and snapped each other's hair. It's a cheap haircut, but it's really cold. It's just going to break everything. So in order to stay alive, you have to take a bite from your muesli bar, lift that up, pull that back down, take another bite, lift that up, and do that the entire way down the road, actually, just to stay alive. So can we give Peter a round of applause, please? I got sick of muesli bars, as you can imagine, eating 20 a day, and I bought power bars one day, which have a higher moisture content in them. I hadn't really thought it through. Thanks. They froze solid, but they were the only food that I had before my next meal, and so I was trying to lever it between my teeth to get a bit off it, and it snapped on an upward motion, and I quite literally thumped myself in the head, and actually had to sit down in the snow for about 10 minutes and just wait for the pain to subside and then walk on. Eventually I made it over into Russia. It wasn't quite as cold as Canada, thankfully, but cold enough. Very difficult going through there. The reception wasn't particularly warm, so to speak. There was only really one church in all of Russia that actually welcomed me in. And he put I don't normally tell this, but now that I'm in Canberra, this Russian priest, big Orthodox priest, knew about Australia. And we just had an election back in 2008. And he said, "Australia, you have new government." I said, yeah, we do. I said, Kevin Rudd was just elected Prime Minister. I said, "They are communists." I said, no, it's Labour. He goes, "Duh, communists." I think I actually emailed Nick with him. The scary thing, a few days after meeting that particular priest, I was walking through an intersection. It was all covered in snow. It was kind of in the middle of nowhere. It was wilderness near a city called Smolensk. And two guys in black came running down the hill through the snow, ran across the road and stopped me from walking. There was a snow drift behind me, so I couldn't go anywhere. They were speaking very aggressively in Russian. All I'd learnt to say in Russian at that point was, please, thank you, where's the church, and can I have fish, please? I learnt that the night before in the little restaurant. And these guys weren't asking for fish or the church, so I had no idea what they were saying. But eventually they nodded at one another, and whack, they both started to thump me, started to beat me up on the side of the road. They ripped the top strap off my backpack in an attempt to get the whole backpack. They broke, I used carbon fibre walking poles. They'd lasted all the way from Brazil. They snapped them both in half. And they were both laying into me. And we'd been fighting for a number of minutes. And I'm trying to keep these two Russians at bay. And I ended up with one around the collar and holding him at arm's length. And the other guy on this side went for an uppercut. So I grabbed him around the throat as well and ended up with a Russian in both hands. Just held them at arm's length and just locked my elbows out and just trying to stop them from punching me. Now, I'm 6'5", so I'm reasonably tall. Both these guys were average height, so they're still trying to punch me, but their arms weren't quite long enough, so they're kind of swinging underneath. Neither of them had cut their fingernails, though. So what they then did was start to claw at my hands, and they literally started to rip the skin off. One, the guy on this side, on the left, put his thumbnail right through the webbing between thumb and forefinger. There's a moon-shaped scar from it. So I wasn't being punched, but it wasn't really working. And as happens, as I discovered, in fights we got off balance at one point, and so I just brought them together as hard as I could and ran, just took off down the road. One of them jumped up with the broken walking poles and gave chase. I could hear the whoosh whoosh behind me as he's trying to hit me. I was wearing a 12 kilogram backpack, and he was really unfit, so it was kind of an even race down the side of the road. He eventually gave up after about 100 metres and went back to help his friend. His friend was injured, he was hurt, so he was laying on the side of the road. So he went back to help him, leaving me to run on down the road. A friend, though, that I was sending all my video footage and photographs to had emailed me and said, Sam, all this bad stuff keeps happening and you keep talking about it afterwards. He said, I know it's a bit difficult, but if you're getting mugged, pull your camera out. So I'm running down the road and thinking, I guess this is what Brendan wants. So I pulled the camera out and stopped. I was about 150 metres from them, stopped and started to film them. And I'm trying to get my breath back. We're fighting for 5 minutes. I've just sprinted 150 metres, trying to explain what's just happened. And a third guy came running down the hill, also dressed in black, but with a bottle of vodka in hand, whistling out to the other two guys because he wants in on the fight. And so this had to turn and run. I finished my sentence off while running, put the camera away, and ran on down the road to this other guy on the other side of the road giving chase. He didn't want to cross without the other two, and they already headed back home, wherever they'd come from. And so he eventually stopped and went back, leaving me to continue on down through. The road was, it was straight through pine forest, so this big Russian pine forest for 20 kilometres. I was paranoid that they would come back in a car with something more than their fists. About five kilometres later, an hour later, an old bomby car drove past and pulled off to the side of the road up ahead of me, and three guys in black stepped out. And I started to go through what all my options were. The obvious thing is walk on the other side of the road to start with. If they make any motion towards me, I thought I'm just going to hit the forest and I'll take my chances in there. It wasn't them, it was three old guys with a flat tyre. It was really scary to walk down the road. By that stage, I'd already been held at gunpoint a few times, been robbed at knife point, been beaten up, come face to face with dangerous animals. Walking down the road was a very difficult mental task to do day in, day out. 2 weeks later, the same thing did happen again. Two guys in black came running out of a forest in Belarus, the next country. One of them had a knife, and they chased for 2.5 kilometres down the road until they gave up and went back. Eventually, though, I made it down into Europe, and the seasons changed. Winter gave way to spring, which then gave way to summer. It was warm. There was fruit growing on the side of the roads that I was able to just pick as I walked along. No one tried to beat me up. It was a really nice way to finish the walk itself. As you can imagine, though, walking for 15,500 kilometres around the world on foot, there were a lot of animals that I came face to face with. Some of them were cute and cuddly, and some of them were not. My favourite encounter was with a pig in Mexico, in southern Mexico. It might sound odd, but of all the animals I saw, but this pig, I sheltered in a fallen down bus stop during a storm in southern Mexico, and the pig came and sheltered with me. But it could smell the food in my backpack. And being a pig, it tried to eat through my backpack to get to the food. And I kept trying to push it away, and every time I put my hand near it, it tried to bite me. And I figured I only really had two options. One was to punch it. I thought, I don't want to do that. I thought, okay, you know, one of my faith heroes is Francis of Assisi, so I'm going to outdo this pig in love. So I put on the Swedish cook accent from the Muppets. And, you know, it's one of those things where, like, if you're at home and you sing or you dance because you're all alone, like, you know, I'm in the middle of southern Mexico, I'm by myself, so started to put on the Swedish cook accent and massage it and tell this pig I was going to make it into bacon if it didn't stop eating my backpack. And the pig forgot about the food. It flopped down on the ground, and as I continued to massage it, it fell asleep. It was groaning, and then it just started to snore. And so by the time the storm finished, I got up very quietly, picked up my backpack, and walked on down the road with the pig snoring in the bus stop. The scariest moment, though, was in South America. I walked 40 kilometres to a town that didn't exist, as in it was on my map, but in reality, there's nothing there. I'd walked out in the middle of nowhere. It's the tropics. It was difficult to carry enough water for an entire day. I managed to get to that 40-kilometre mark. I had nothing left, but there's nowhere to replenish my water supply. There was another town on my map 15 kilometres further on, so I walked onto that. The sun set in the meantime. There were caiman on the side of the road. Caiman are South America's version of crocodiles. So I was very deliberately walking down the middle of the road singing Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World as loud as I could, just so they'd scatter off the road. And I just kept making noise and they could hear them scattering, and I walked on down the middle of the road. Eventually made it to the second town, and it was nothing more than a power station. There was no one there, it was unstaffed, there was a huge security fence around it. I'd walked that day out across savanna, and all I had at that stage was a hammock. You can't put a hammock up in grass. It doesn't work. I didn't want to sleep in the grass because the week before that, I'd seen a Guyana boa constrictor and an anaconda. Both of them kind of... I won't point to anything because no one can actually see... Not everyone can see where I'm pointing. 10 metres long, roughly. Big snake, but you don't want to sleep in the grass when they're around. So I decided to walk on. I was already becoming dehydrated and walked on and on and on. My body basically started to shut down, organs were shutting down. I went 7 hours without being able to produce saliva. It was midnight. I'd walked 66 kilometres and was in bad shape. I couldn't use the walking poles anymore. My arms were kind of dead. You know, if you'd ever done push-ups at the point where you can't do any more, for some of us that's one. But so I had the poles up under my arms and was walking down the road in rubber-soled boots, so making no sound, really. And I turned the torch off just to conserve the batteries for when I needed it. So you can't hear me, you can't see me. I'm walking silently down a pitch-black road in South America, and I walked to within 2 metres of a puma. Now, a puma, a mountain lion, and a cougar are the same animal, different name from different countries. And it was crouched down low in the grass is about a metre tall, just on the side of the road, and it was coming towards me very, very slowly, just one paw at a time. It would put one paw forward, just inch it forward bit by bit, put it down, and then inch its body forward over that leg and then bring the back leg forward. I had a safety whistle built into the top strap of my backpack, which the Russians later broke up in the fight. I ripped that up into my mouth and started to blow that as loudly as I could. I had the torch in its eyes. In theory, I thought that the whistle and the torch would deter it. It didn't. It just kept walking forward, little by little, and the grass just continued to part. I had one walking pole ready to poke, one ready to whack in case it jumped. I've never been more scared in my life. And I still remember the hair on the back of my neck standing up on end and having the thought of, wow, it does stand up on end when you're really, really scared. And eventually, though, it occurred to me that it was probably a good idea to walk backwards. It just hadn't occurred to me that that was the smart thing to do. And so very, with jelly legs just started to back away from it, and thankfully at that point it laid down on its stomach and let me continue on back up the road. Very scared that there might be two of them, so I'm flashing the torch around everywhere, walking back up the middle of the road. Got about a kilometre back up the road in the wrong direction, and the puma let out a very loud roar. Now, a puma doesn't sound like a lion. It sounds like your house cat on steroids. And it was enough incentive to go a few more kilometres up the road, and I was in so much pain, I couldn't go any further. There was no way I was going to go back past this puma, and so sat down on the side of the road. Couldn't fall asleep for obvious reasons, but eventually did for about 45 minutes at 4 a.m. It was definitely the scariest moment of the walk itself. Struck out by so many snakes, it's not funny, and I hate snakes. So that also wasn't so nice. The biggest impact on me, though, over the course of the journey were the people that I met every day. Every single day, there was someone or some people who played a significant role in the mission, in the journey. There was a young guy I met in... there's a young family I met in Venezuela, and this was before the puma. I hadn't yet learnt the lesson about walking at night time with the torch off, that it wasn't smart, and it was a worse situation. I would not do it now, and I wouldn't recommend it. Walking down the road through jungle, this thick jungle on both sides, and I had the torch turned off, and walking through pitch darkness, actually laughing at the fact that I couldn't even see my hand in front of my face. And bang, walked into another man walking in the other direction. And we both thought the world had ended. We both thought that something had just begun to attack us, and we're fumbling away from each other. I pulled my torch out and flashed it on him. He didn't have a torch, so he's been hit by something and is now being blinded by a light. But I could see that he was probably a bit more scared at that stage than I was of him. I at least knew that it was human. And so I turned the torch on myself and calmed him down, and then two heads popped out from behind him. His two little boys, Fernando and Junior. And they were following Dad home. They were all holding onto each other's onto their shirts, following each other home to their jungle home. And the dad ended up offering me accommodation for the night. I'd been walking trying to find somewhere. I didn't want to sleep in the jungle, so I was trying to find anywhere. And so he invited me back to their place. Their house was what we would call a chicken coop. It was a dirt floor, tin, like no bigger than this little area in front of me. It was the size of their home, split into two rooms, chicken wire for windows, no running water, no electricity. But they let me stay. We had a fun time over dinner. All he had for light was one little diesel lamp. That was it. That was their one source of light. And they blew that out at about 8 p.m. and off to bed we went in our hammocks. And the next morning, the two little boys were riding their guard dog around like a horse until he got sick of that and laid down. So they went and grabbed their one toy, which was a plastic ball. And they put a rock on the ground and were taking it in turns to try and hit the rock. But they kept nagging their dad for something. And my Spanish was very poor, had no idea what they were asking for, but their dad relented and said, okay, I'll get it for you. And the boys started to celebrate. And the dad went into the other little room and came back and put onto the little kitchen table they had roll-on deodorant, picked up his machete and went bang, and popped out a second identical plastic ball to the first one. And the boys ran around, picked up the ball, high-fived each other, drew a circle on the ground and started to play marbles. And they did not stop smiling the entire time. It was like Christmas morning. They now had a toy each. The lifestyle they lived was so incredibly basic, but their generosity was extraordinary. About 2 weeks later, though, I ran into a guy with a gun who wasn't quite as hospitable. I sat down on the side of the road to eat my lunch in the middle of the day and thought I was all alone out in the countryside, and so I was surprised to hear from behind me someone go, "Oi!" And I swung around and had a shotgun pushed into my head. He cocked it and put his finger on the trigger and was frantic. Like, I seriously thought he was going to accidentally pull the trigger, let alone do it on purpose. Does anyone want to take a guess as to why he was going to kill me? I wasn't on his property and he didn't want my food.
Red and white shirt.
It wasn't that I was wearing a red and white shirt. I didn't actually have it at that stage.
I thought you were a cop.
Didn't think I was a cop. He thought I was an American. And in Venezuela, the president of Venezuela in 2007, he's still president now, Hugo Chavez, was telling the Venezuelans that George Bush is Satan and Americans are the spawn of Satan and they need to be ridded from Venezuela like rats from a sewer. And if they don't go, kill them. And they have a name for people from America, gringo. Now, all throughout Latin America, they call them gringos. It means someone from the USA. But in Venezuela, in some parts of Venezuela, it has a connotation that's a lot deeper. Very similar to a word that's now essentially banned from the English language. Nigger. It carries the same hatred with it. And I walked into towns in Venezuela where women ran out onto the streets screaming, going, gringo, gringo, and herding their children up and running them inside and locking the doors and slamming the shutters on the windows closed until the young men of the town eventually emerged with stones trying to hit me, trying to stone me. And so I just had to run out of those towns, get out of those villages as quick as I could. This guy with the gun, once he found out I was an Australian Catholic missionary, he apologised and put the gun down and asked me how the mission was going and how the churches were receiving me. And I said, it's been difficult. And he said, well, you look like a gringo. He said, and he invited me to sit back down and finish my lunch, but I'd lost my appetite, so I decided to walk on. But as I walked off, I turned back to him and said, excuse me, sir, that's a really nice gun you have. Do you mind if I take a photograph of you and your gun? And he didn't say anything. He just went and waited for me to take his picture. But every single day, there was someone who played a significant role in the journey. And probably one of the more heart-moving moments, or heart-warming moments, was in southern France. I arrived in a very small town at the end of a long, hot day, and I was tired, and I was not in the mood for searching for any churches. I couldn't see any. And there was an old guy, like in his 80s, sitting in a bus stop. And so in my poor French, I asked him if he knew if there were any churches in town. And he stood up with his walking stick. He was only just taller than my hip. And he looked up into the town and in French says, oui, 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 there's one church in town. He said, but it's too difficult to describe how to get there. He said, come on, I'll walk you. And at this pace, with his walking stick, he walked me a kilometre and a half up over a hill to the local church. And once we could see it, he just pointed to it. And we chatted the whole way up. And he kept complaining about how slow he was and that he wasn't young anymore. And he pointed to the church and said, there it is, shook my hand and said, keep going with the mission. Turned around and walked himself all the way back down to his bus stop. So the sheer generosity of that guy, his name was Rohan, was just extraordinary, just to a complete stranger. What I want to do, though, to finish off with, is to talk about the two biggest lessons that I learned along the way. I haven't really spoken about the mission. The two big lessons for me. One, if you're sitting there thinking, cool journey, stupid reason for walking around the world, I want to talk about why unity and what I learned about it while I was walking. The second thing, being the biggest lesson for me, was that God is trustworthy. I think it went from head knowledge to heart knowledge. So the first bit, why unity? I started walking and praying for unity and truth between the churches, but it took it on a different shape by the time I arrived in Panama in Central America. I arrived in a small town, a small village of three rows of houses surrounded by jungle, and no one in the village had talked to me. They literally, I couldn't even introduce myself. They'd flick their hand at me and walk away. I just assumed it was because they thought I was a gringo. But at the end of the night, once everyone in the village had gone back to their homes, it was dark, this one guy walked up to me. He's 24 years old, had his three-year-old daughter in hand, and he walked up and introduced himself and asked why I was in the village and who I was. And he was so excited about the mission, and he said, oh, do you need somewhere to sleep tonight? I said, oh, please, it'd be great. And he said, you can sleep at my house. I don't think my wife will mind. And so I followed him out of the village. He didn't live in that three rows of houses. And we walked down a hill, through some trees, across a creek, up through some banana palms, up onto a cleared field to his home. His home wasn't even chicken coop worthy. We'd use it as a woodshed. It was a tin shed that had like one side was missing. There was no door across it. Dirt floor, No running water, no toilet, no bathroom, no kitchen. There was just a little campfire. And he lived in there with his wife and daughter. And they had to sling their hammocks from the ceiling in order to keep away from the wild animals. And when we got there, he asked if I needed something to eat. And I could see there was no shelves or pantry. You could see he didn't have much. But I was really hungry and just said, look, anything you've got would be great, please. And he said, I'll wait here a second. And he ran back up into the village and went door knocking and came back 10 minutes later with half a bread roll and a slice of sausage on it and gave it to me to eat for dinner. The next morning, his wife and daughter walked hand in hand up into the village, leaving... Now, this guy's name was Adolfo. So leaving Adolfo and I to have breakfast together. And breakfast was wild lemongrass cut and put into a pot and boiled up to make lemongrass tea. And he went back to the village and got two bread rolls, a bread roll each. And we were talking over breakfast, and I kept peppering him on questions about his life there. And he was answering the questions, but he's getting quieter and quieter as I probed. And eventually he stopped talking, looked at the ground, and burst out crying. And he looked back up at me with tears in his eyes and said, Sam, tomorrow morning I'm leaving my wife and daughter. He said, you know last night up in the village how no one would talk to you? He said, it's not because you're a gringo. It's because you're not one of them. And in this village, if you're not one of them, you're never one of them. I wasn't born here. I moved here 6 months ago with my wife. Her parents live in the village. They're an elderly couple. And they're the only people I can beg from. That's where I got the bread rolls from. He said, last night, when I went and got that bread roll for you for dinner, I was also asking, I was begging them for food for us too, but they wouldn't give us any. Her parents wouldn't give us any. So we went without dinner last night. He said, because no one will talk to me in the village, I can't get a job. I keep asking and they just flick their hand at me and walk away. And because I don't have a job, we have no money. And so we can't buy food. And so my wife and I put all our money together and bought a bus ticket. And tomorrow morning I'm travelling to Panama City, 200 kilometres away. And he said, I'm going to live on the streets and just find work. And as I make money, I'll send it home so that my wife can at least go and buy food so they can eat. He said, I'm so lonely here. He said, I've got no friends. He said, my wife and daughter are the only friends that I've got. And I don't want to leave them. But he said, we don't have any choice. And he was still crying when he got up and walked back into his little house. And he came back out with his daughter's toy. And he had around his thumb a little thumb rosary. And he took it off, had a cross around the end of it, and he pushed it down over the toy's head and attached it to the side of my backpack. I've still got it with me. And when he attached it to my backpack, I'll show it to you. It's Dino. That was her toy. You see the cross around his neck. I don't know if you can or not. And when he attached Dino to the side of my backpack, he said, Sam, I'm giving you this so you don't forget me. He said, please remember me as you walk on. He said, and please remember to pray for me and pray for my wife and daughter while I'm away from them. He said, I'll never be able to see the world as you're seeing it. I won't be able to get to see all of Panama. He said, every single day for us is a struggle to stay alive. He said, please just don't forget me. And I walked on from that village that day with Dino flicking into view every step that I took for the next 11,000 kilometres. And I walked on from that village that day feeling disgustingly rich. I'd gone through my entire schooling and university and then working with Youth Mission Team, comparing myself to everyone else. I've got a four-cylinder Camry and Nico's got a V6, and it's just not fair. And I'd never had to compare myself to someone like Adolfo. And it ripped me. And I stopped walking twice that day, completely disillusioned with what I was doing, and sat down on the side of the road and thought, why am I doing this? No, surely there's 100 other things I could be doing that are more worthwhile than praying for unity. And I kept moving on down the road, eventually ran into a German missionary priest.
and he's Dominican. And I explained the mission to him, and straight off the cuff said, he said back to me, "I don't care for what you're doing, I don't think God does either." I said, "Whoa, hang on a second. Like, yeah, I'm feeling a bit down at the moment, but what do you mean God doesn't care about what I'm doing?" I said, "But in the Gospel of John, John 17, before the Passion, Jesus prays for the complete unity of all people of faith. What do you mean he doesn't care about what I'm doing?" And he said, "By the sounds of it, you're walking and praying for unity and truth, that the church would agree theologically," which I was. He said, "That wasn't what Jesus was praying for." He said, "He was praying that we love one another. He wasn't praying that we agree with one another." He said, "Unfortunately, we live in a world where people think it's enough to agree and not to love." He said, "There's a very big difference." And being a Dominican, he gave me a lecture for half an hour on his doorstep, and then eventually invited me inside, gave me dinner and a bed for the night, and sent me on my way the next day. And I walked on with a new sense of conviction about the importance of unity, and at least praying for it, but knowing full well that I couldn't just leave it at prayer. That there was so much, so many opportunities for me to put it into action. If I could put an Australian definition on it, to say that unity in love is to care seems a bit soft. Unity in love is that we give a stuff about each other, that we get involved in each other's lives. And whether it's, within our own lives, or the people around us, just feeling, people feeling like if they even open up to someone, they're going to be ridiculed, or told they got themselves into this situation, or they should know better, or are you praying? Through to those around us in our wider community, from the homeless to those who are dying lonely, those who are living lonely, through to refugees, through to right to life. Somewhere like Guatemala City, there were 21 murders a day. They'd walk up behind people, shoot them in the back of the head, and then steal $10 from them, because that was worth more than their life. So there's so many different ways that the opportunities we have to give a stuff and to put love into action. And so now that I'm back in Australia, kind of still praying for unity, but realising that there's so many opportunities to actually get involved. So does everyone have a good idea of what I was walking and praying for with unity? Yeah. The last thing I want to finish with, the big lesson, second lesson, was that God is trustworthy, and it was driven home in the state of Wyoming in the United States. It was minus 22 degrees Celsius at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I arrived in a small town on the edge of Shirley Basin. It was 148 kilometres across Shirley Basin to the next town of Casper. 148 k's was 3 days of solid walking. At minus 22, my water supply was frozen solid. There was nothing in between. It was 1,000 metres above sea level with the Rocky Mountains rising up all the way around it. Enormous basin. If you've ever seen Dances with Wolves, it was similar terrain. They actually filmed that nearby. I kept asking the locals what my options were. And they're saying, you don't have options. There is nothing out there. One guy even said to me, "Gee whiz, you walked all the way from Brazil? Man, that is awesome." "Don't do it." He said, "Get the bus." He's very serious, saying your mission is about prayer and inviting people to pray for unity. There's only deer out there and they're freezing to death at the moment. Don't do it. Get the bus. Don't risk the mission. You've got a lot more ground to cover before you finish. My backpack was small. I could only carry a day and a half's worth of food. Gets me halfway. Got another day and a half without food. I had to sleep in my tent for 2 nights to do the crossing. If it's minus 22 at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, imagine what it gets to when the sun goes down. So eventually I relented and said, "Okay, I admit it would be irresponsible of me to walk across Shirley Basin. I will get the bus." I walked into the pub and bought myself a counter meal and sat down in the corner. I don't know if you ever, when you go to church or something, you're just quiet before God, not actually praying anything or saying anything, you're just quiet. That's what I was doing, except I wasn't in church, I was in a pub. Being quiet before God. And it just felt like God said one word and one word alone. Trust. As in, trust me. And I've been through so much to get to that point. I figured, okay, God, I'm not going to ignore this. I'll do it. But if I die out there, it's your fault. And so God went to bed early and got up very early the next morning and headed out across Shirley Basin. It was frozen solid. There was ice and snow everywhere. The wind was coming in off the Arctic. And it was actually picking the snow up off the ground and hitting me from the front. But after sunrise, the wind coughed and spluttered. swung around to the west and hit me at 80 kilometres an hour. It's what the local Indians call a Chinook wind. It's a weather anomaly. It's a dry, warm wind that doesn't melt snow. It evaporates it. And over the course of the day, Shirley Basin went from a frozen wasteland to not one skerrit of ice anywhere. And by the end of the day, it was 7 degrees Celsius. The temperature had just skyrocketed. And I finished the day in a t-shirt and a baseball cap. And put my tent down after 50 kilometres out in the middle of Shirley Basin with white-tailed deer and antelope grazing around me. And the wind stopped, it was dead calm, it was beautifully peaceful. Went to sleep and slept until 2:30 a.m. and woke up colder than I've ever been in my life. I'm adamant it was colder than the minus 33, but we've got no way of proving it. It certainly felt like it. I was in full thermals, including the balaclava, inside a thermal sock, inside my sleeping bag, inside a survival bag, curled up in a fetal position inside my one-man tent, and couldn't stop shivering. And it got to, what had happened was all the cold air on the mountains had just plummeted down into the basin over the course of the night, and it got to the point where the shivering so much, and I knew that it was detrimental to my health to shiver for more than 5 minutes, and I knew I needed to get out and get walking and get warmth back into my body. But if you've ever woken up at night time and need to go to the toilet, but you don't want to go to the toilet because you're so tired you want to go back to sleep, but you can't get back to sleep because you need to go to the toilet, it's the same deal. Eventually, after half an hour, was awake enough to think, this is ridiculous, I need to get out of this tent. Pulled myself out of all the gear, and above my head on the little one-man tent were icicles from my breath. I don't know how cold it was, but it's cold enough when you go, it goes and freezes to fabric. I could scrape my breath back off. And it was hard enough to undo the muesli bars. Ridiculous trying to pack the tent up. Eventually, power walked on across Shirley Basin. The sun rose, got some warmth back into my body. Had walked on for 5 hours, but my water supply was rock solid, and so now I was dehydrating. I'd averted hypothermia, but I'm dehydrating. A white pickup, a ute, came rumbling down across Shirley Basin and pulled up alongside me. And the guy wound his window down and said, what in the hell are you doing out here? And I thought about, his name was Gary. I thought about saying to Gary, I'm walking to Casper and leaving it at that. But I thought, oh, you stopped, got his attention. I might as well give him the full spiel, what I'm doing and why. And he just stared at me. I'm half expecting him to wind the window back up and just drive on down the road. And then eventually he started smiling and he was shaking his head and he goes, hallelujah, Jesus! And he was the most full-on evangelical Christian I think I've ever met in my life. Nearly every sentence finished with a faith connotation. He asked where I was from. And I said, I'm from Tasmania in Australia. He said, oh, you're from Tassie? Oh, praise you, Jesus! Like, everything finished with a faith connotation, faith affirmation. And he was so excited about the mission, and he said, I'll be praying for unity, and I'll take the mission to my church this weekend. He said, you need a drink? Oh, please. Some water supply's frozen solid. And he reached down and picked up this huge bottle of Gatorade and said, I bought this when I left home, but as soon as I took off, I thought, well, that was stupid. I don't even like Gatorade. So he hadn't opened it. So he threw me that and ferreted around and found some Snickers bars for me and threw me those as well. And I walked on down the road, rehydrating and on a sugar high. And later in the day, well into the afternoon, for whatever reason, I had a craving for peanut butter. It just happens. And the white pickup came rumbling down across Shirley Basin in the other direction. And Gary jumped out and said, Sam, I wanted to get you something when I was in Casper, but I've got no idea what you like, so I bought you some Reese Buttercups. I had no idea what they were. I'd never heard of them. They weren't in Australia at that point. And so I just thanked him and walked on down the road and bit into it and just went, you beauty. And if you don't know what they are, they're chocolate cupcakes filled with peanut butter. They'll kill you, but they're brilliant. And so finished them all in 5 minutes flat and was feeling sick. At the end of the second day, as the sun had just set, I arrived at the one ranch that the locals had told me was out there. They said, if you get into trouble, there is a front gate to a ranch. If you get, you know, you need to get to that point at least. And there's a nice flat spot to put my tent down. So I walked up in darkness up to the farmhouse to ask for permission to put my tent there. Now, you know, most farms or ranches, they have a farmhouse, some sheds and a windmill. This fella had a farmhouse, some sheds and a stadium. A full-on indoor rodeo stadium sitting on his ranch. All under floodlight around the outside because they were in training for the state rodeo championships that weekend. And I walked up to one guy who was welding a broken gate up and said, just ask him where the owner was. And he pointed to the stadium and said, just go through that door over there. He's in there with two other guys. They're having a meeting. I walked on in and there's three guys at the bull release gate, all with their leg up on the gate in the middle of the arena, having their official meeting in their full cowboy regalia. Got cowboy hats, vests, chaps down the front of their legs and spurs on the back of their boots. One guy's got straw hanging out of his mouth. And I walked in 50 metres away and they turned and looked at me and bang, there's a power failure. And I had on my head a little LED walker's lamp. Flipped it on and we were the only people with light. The head cowboy, his name was Jet. Jet the cowboy. He swaggered off the gate towards me and said, well, I got no idea who you are, but I'm sure glad you came. And Jet turned out to be Christian. He said he'd take on the invitation to pray for unity. He said, please don't put your tent down the front gate. He said, stick it up here anywhere you like. They fixed the blown fuse and eventually packed up and they all left. Lights down. I got into my tent and thought, Sam, you're an idiot. It's the end of the second day and I've got no food left. I hadn't had dinner. And I thought if I'd only asked Jet, who's such a nice guy, I'm sure he would have given me something. And then I could hear footsteps coming towards the tent and unzipped it to make sure it wasn't a rogue cow walking at me. And it was Jet, fumbling through the darkness with his arms laden full of food. He'd gone up to the little home nearby, which his grandparents, they were so excited about the mission that they had emptied the oven of everything they'd just cooked. It was piping hot. All this stuff from the fridge and the pantry. He was seriously struggling to hold it all. And it was enough food to have dinner that night, breakfast the next morning, and a light lunch and walk into Casper at 4 o'clock in the afternoon the next day. When I walked into Casper, the first thing I saw was a Super 8 motel. And I was in love with that hotel. I hadn't had a shower in those 3 days. I was wheezing badly from a chest infection from the first night sleeping in Shirley Basin, and my left foot was bleeding so badly that it was squelching in blood every step I took, and it felt like a cigarette lighter was on underneath it. So I was not in that place of being quiet before God. I was in love with the hotel I could see up ahead of me. But it's as though God overrode my thoughts. It felt like God said, Sam, you didn't come here to go to hotels. You came here to go to churches. Do the mission. I was indignant. I couldn't believe that either I had thought it or God had asked it of me. If Jesus was walking along beside me, I might have just hit him in front of an oncoming bus and run on to the hotel before he got up again. I didn't want to contemplate it and really grappled with it. Really struggled with what I was going to do. And it wasn't until I got outside the hotel that I finally gave up on it and said, okay, God, I'll do it. I'll go to the churches. Whatever. I really don't care right now. And walked on begrudgingly past hotel after hotel and locked church after locked church. And they always seem to be on the other side of the road to each other. And so I'm wheezing and squelching and limping. And it was after an hour of this, hadn't met anyone. All the churches are locked. And so, I met a cleaner at one church. And so I eventually prayed a quick prayer and said, God, I need to stop and you know I need to stop. But I'll do one more church. I'll find one more. The next church I found was a Catholic church. I knocked on the presbytery door and a mini version of Hagrid opened up. This huge bloke with a beard. And I explained the mission and asked him if he wouldn't mind passing it on to his congregation. And he just turned around and looked inside and then turned back to me and said, my dinner's in there on the table getting cold. And my team is about to play off in the World Series baseball final. This is the most inappropriate time possible. But God only puts people in my life at inappropriate times. So can I at least find you somewhere to sleep? I said, yes, please. He put me upstairs in the Marriott, 5-star hotel for 2 nights. And his name was Father Fox. And he came and picked me up the next morning, drove me to Mass, And as we were walking out of Mass together, he got me up at the end to introduce the mission to the congregation, and we walked out during the final hymn. He leaned across and said, "Sam, I've got a confession to make. I made a few phone calls." We walked out of the church into a press conference. He rung the state newspapers, television crews and radio stations. They asked the first question, why'd you walk across Shirley Basin? The answer surprised them. And the obvious question from there was, why unity? And I drew breath to begin to answer it, and Father Fox stepped in front of me and answered it so much more beautifully and succinctly than I could have done at that point. And I'm standing behind him thinking, hang on a second, where did this come from? And one of the newspaper reporters leant forward and said, "Sorry, who are you?" And he said, "I'm Father Fox. I'm Wyoming's delegate for the unity of Christians." The invitation to pray for unity was on the nightly news channels, on the front page of the newspapers, and the radio stations were running with it. One radio station did hourly updates. They'd open their phone lines up. If you see the big Aussie walking down the side of the road, stop and say, "G'day." Let him know we're praying for him. Give him a cup of coffee. It's cold out there. He's Justin Bieber. We'll be back in a second. And every hour, I'd have people stopping on the side of the road with little comfort packs. And they'd be on their mobile letting the radio station know that everything was going fine. And it snowballed. It never took off in Australia. But the media over there ran with it. It went through Wyoming, Montana. It became one of the feature stories in Canada at one point, actually because it was a minor story, and they went back and the two news anchors had a fight over it because one of them paid me out for my Aussie accent, and the other one got stuck into him and told him that he missed the point of what he was doing, and that was a stupid comment. And she said, "Well, for one, I'll be praying for unity." And then the other media started to run with it. The Vatican heard about it. They put it out through their media. It took off in Malta. I didn't walk through Malta, but I've got all these people emailing me saying, "We're praying for unity. If you want to come over, you can come and stay at our place in Gozo or wherever." And when I got to Poland, a TV show came and did their show on the road with me. In Slovakia, there was a huge unity concert in Bratislava, the capital. And I was a guest speaker with a translator. I learned a little bit of Slovakian, but not that much. It took off. The invitation to pray for unity went so much further than I could have carried it. And I look back on it and realise that I very nearly missed it. Because I nearly took the bus. I nearly did what everyone was telling me was the responsible thing to do and what I should do. And what I should do in order to not put the mission in jeopardy. They had my best interests at heart. But it wasn't what God was asking me to do. And the bus would have dropped me a kilometre past Father Fox, and I would have walked on doing the same thing. Still would have been fruitful, but nowhere near the substance or, you know, the fruit that was born through going through the pain. We've got to be real about it. It hurts to trust God. Taking the bus is the easy option. But the fruit born from trusting God and walking across Shirley Basin was so much more substantial and satisfying than taking the bus. And I realise now that I'm back in Australia, metaphorically speaking, I still take the bus. I only got married 9 months ago, and in marriage I feel like I'm standing in Brazil. I feel like I've got so much more walking to go before I get to Shirley Basin and just say, "Okay, God, I'll walk." And I think the hardest place to trust God is boyfriend, girlfriend, particularly. And as odd as that sounds, I think it's the one place where most people push God out completely and say, "No, I'll see you when I'm 25, 35, when I get married. Then you can come back." It doesn't get that much easier when you get married, but I think, you know, probably when you have kids, then it's harder again to trust God with the kids. But those relationships, that family unit is where unity begins. And then it steps out from there into a wider community. The invitation I was taking around the world was to pray for unity every day at 4:01. To set an alarm on your watch or your phone, and at 4:01 to pray for one. Do you get it? Pray for one at 4:01, pray for unity. You can do AM, I do PM. And if you decide to pray for unity each day at 4:01, please also pray for whatever it is you are interested in. What you give a stuff about? What makes your blood boil? And don't just ask God to fix it, but ask God to use you. So continue to pray for it. Say, God, if you need me in any way, please, I'm yours. Use me, help me. The tough thing then is to trust God, because it might be another 20 or 30 years before you get that chance. But just to continue to pray for it and know that your prayers are actually making a difference in that. Thank you very much for your attention. Sorry for going over time by a bit. And all the best in your own journey. Thank you.
That was Sam Clear on Pumas, Prayers and Pistols, the Fight for Christian Unity. Guinness and God is presented once a month at King O'Malley's Pub in Canberra. And for more, visit cradio.org.au.